Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experience within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. With me today is Jeff Gitterman. For those of you plugged into the impact and ESG space, you probably have heard of Jeff as he is a recognized thought leader within the industry. But not only is he a thought leader, he is a co-founding partner in Gitterman Wealth Management and is active in helping clients implement impact, ESG, and sustainability into their portfolios. His book, Beyond Success, Redefining the Meaning of Prosperity, is also on my bookshelf, and I've read it. It's excellent. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to jump right in. I only gave a little bit of context because I want you to fill this in. Give us some idea of your background. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? A little high level of your career.
Yeah, born in Queens, New York. Like the fact that I'm a native New Yorker. Still live in Manhattan these days. Went to Rider College, now Rider University, but it was just a college when I went there. They got an upgrade, I guess, after I left. And I did some master's studies after that. But you know what is funny? I actually finished all my coursework for my master's and then got the opportunity to write the book that's on your bookshelf. And I told my proctor of my master's program that I had this really short window. They gave me 3 months to write the whole book. And I didn't have time to also do the 50-page dissertation. And I said, could I submit my book for the dissertation? And they wouldn't let me. So
they wouldn't let you?
No. So I didn't get the degree. I did all the 2 years of coursework, didn't get the degree, but I got a book out of it. Not too bad, I guess.
Not too bad. And a little bit about your career.
Yeah. So I've been in wealth management since 1990. I can't believe it's 31 years. I still think I'm 30 years old, but been in, direct to consumer wealth management. Now we're also in, kind of B2B, where we act as an outsourced CIO for other firms to bring ESG and sustainable strategies to advisors around the country that don't have the bandwidth to build their own platform. And we've got, a company we're advising on about $1.5 billion in assets direct to client, and then also a whole separate outsourced CIO business on really how to use capital for good, which I think is the theme of this show and why I like, what you guys do so much, certainly.
You have so many interests and you're doing so many great things in this space. I'm anxious to hear you're going to answer this, but how would you best describe who you are in the context of kind of where you're at in your journey?
I'm 55 years old. And when I turned 50, it was the first time I did a presentation at Morningstar back in 2016 on not the main stage, but in a side room. But there were about a couple hundred people there. It's the first time I spoke publicly about ESG and sustainable investing. And I honestly can tell you, I was standing on the stage and knew after 50 years of kind of searching for what I should be doing in the world, like always feeling like I had a bigger purpose. I mean, I think, a lot of people feel that way, but always feeling that, but never really feeling like I had nailed what it was. And in that moment on that stage, I literally said to myself, this is it. The feeling I have coming back from the audience, the passion I have, what I'm speaking about, the impact I can have because of my place in the industry, it all just came together. And I had a, what I like to say is I had a good midlife crisis. And I converted my whole book of business to sustainable investing, which is about $100 million over the next 2 years. And really just spent the last couple of years honing in on how to spread that message to other advisors and how to infect other advisors with my passion for using capital for good, really.
So this next question, I think, how are you trying to change the world specifically? And then I'd also love to know, what is it that went off in your brain that said, yeah, this is what I'm meant to do? What is it and why do you think that happened?
I've had lots of feelings in my life of being in flow, like Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi's book, which I think everyone should read, because if you haven't had that experience, you should at least learn what it is like, so you could try to gravitate towards it. But, the experience of flow is that whatever you're doing, time is passing by without notice. It's effortless in a way. Not that it doesn't take work. It could be hard work, but it feels effortless. It doesn't feel taxing. It doesn't feel like a burden. It actually feels like energy is coursing through you from the universe kind of out. I mean, I don't want to, you know, not trying to make like a spiritual reference. Sure. But it really feels like you're getting like, you could work for 8 hours when it's something that you're passionate about. And, or in my case, I could talk about it for 8 hours and just feel like I could go another 8 hours, you know, where there's 100 other things I could do in my day, you know, paperwork, whatever, you know, it might be an account transfer, you know, a loan. Like, I don't feel that with any of that. But it, on that stage, it was the highest feeling of flow that I had, tied to the fact that I knew I can use that state to have a big impact. So tying into the second part of that question, I felt like I was in the pivotal place, because all the other people coming to the advisor marketplace to talk about sustainable and impact investing at that time were mostly educators. The asset management industry really hadn't gotten on board yet, or it was some small fund companies, you know, wholesalers that were talking about it. But it, you've been around the whole time, so you know that there was not another advisor, except maybe Paul Ellis, who's, you know, a dear friend today, and I gravitated to him right away in the beginning, who was, you know, and he was out there doing consulting, but there was no one out there on a big stage mm-hmm. talking about this movement. Mm-hmm. And I recognized that I had an opportunity to really shift the industry. And I'll tell you, like, you know, because you know me, what happened after that. But, you know, all of a sudden the UN was saying, hey, you know, you want to do this conference here. I mean, we did a conference that next year in New York City at the Open Center. And I think we had, you know, 80, 90 advisors come. And 2 years later, we were doing it at the UN and we had 700 advisors coming and we were turning away 200 people. We had the whole asset management industry there in the UN. They were blown away. They said it was the first time in the history of the UN that we brought that much wealth and money represented by all the companies and the advisors into the UN to talk about the sustainable development goals. And that all happened. I mean, what does Thoreau say when you're aligned with passion, purpose, and yeah. the universe then conspires to help you? I honestly feel like that is what has happened to me the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about, I guess you were saying 2016, I was exposed for the first time and was waking up to the idea of, you know, how do I think about my investment capital in 2014. Eventually, you know, it took me another year to make that shift from traditional finance. But I remember during that time, I'm thinking, am I crazy? Is this really something, or am I just making it up? And yeah. and it's guys like you and others who you go, no, this is legit. This is a real deal. So it's cool to have you on going back to that time, because people forget, like, impact ESG today, it's more of a normal phrase. Right. 5 years ago, no, not at all.
I was at a bachelor party in like 2016, maybe 17. And this guy introduced me, who had invited me there, to his buddy, who was a hedge fund manager, big hedge fund in New York. And you know, he said, oh, you know, this Jeff, he does sustainable investing. And I'll never forget this. The guy patted me on the back and said, yeah, it's just a fad. The minute the market goes down, no one's going to, you know, knock on your door ever again. Good luck. And walked away. And I'll never forget that. And, you know, I'd love to find that guy. I don't know his name or, you know, at this point, but I'd love yeah. to find him and say, well, you know, now half the hedge funds are figuring out how to do the S and ESG to get alpha. And it really changed rapidly, you know, and I'm really fortunate because I ride on the backs of lots of people that, you know, have been trying to do this, you know, through SRI and First Affirmative and yeah. you know, Green Century for 20 years and got really lucky. It came in at the point where it kind of had this huge shift. And
this takes me back. And this would have been, I guess, in the late 90s. I can remember having discussion with a Calvert wholesaler, and I won't mention his name, is a great guy. And I remember at the time thinking, great idea, but it didn't make sense to me. And then you fast forward to today, and it's like, I can't think about investing any other way.
Yeah.
It's amazing how it shifts.
There's this concept that I have, that think about like a big funnel. And going into the top of that funnel is all of this data that we didn't have, 10 years ago. It's millions and billions of bits of data around companies' environmental, social, and governance, attributes. And right below that, there's these companies like SASB and GIN and GRI who are saying, okay, there's all this data, but some of that data is actually really material to performance and stock price. And right below that is the asset manager saying, okay, I can actually use this data now that it's material to look at companies that are creating more value in the industry and might have much more long-term prospects because of that additional value they're creating around these factors and these data points. And then at the end of that funnel, there's the investor who's standing there saying, not only do I want to invest in companies that represent my purpose and my values mm-hmm. and my passion, but I also want to buy their product. So there's this virtuous circle because these companies are now getting, cheaper access to capital because they have higher scoring mm-hmm. and ratings that are material. And it just keeps recirculating through this funnel. And what advisors are missing completely, they haven't made the connection yet, is that this virtuous circle is making companies that are really adhering to these points and listening to the marketplace more profitable and more valuable. That's the alpha. Mm-hmm. Like the argument about alpha in a passive ESG index versus the benchmark, I think is foolish because the companies that have been underperforming that have allowed those passive benchmarks to outperform, they're going to figure out how to game the system. They're going to work on improving their data. And then the benchmark's going to outperform the ESG passive benchmark because they don't have any of the companies that are rapidly improving in it. So that's a bad example. And I've been saying for years, the industry should not be representing that there's alpha because those passive benchmarks have outperformed. But when an active manager is looking at all this data and making a decision to own, Pepsi over Coke because they're looking at slave trade and they're looking at human rights issues and their supply chain and all of these things make that company over time, more profitable and more sustainable.
What's interesting is some of what you're talking about is it's just common sense if you really sit and think about it. But I think we've been lured into, and I don't mean to disparage Wall Street because there are a lot of good things that Wall Street has brought. But, this idea of quarterly earnings and driving that at any expense, you start to lose this idea of, this is a long-term game. And the way to manage these businesses is not just quarterly, but the system today is not set up that way.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
So let me dig in a little bit. And I don't know if it doesn't sound like this happened when you were speaking. I'm sure there's other experiences, but when did you kind of wake up to the power of capital, recognizing that it's probably more than just currency or just for yourself?
I had the great experience to get involved with a movie called Planetary back in 2014. It came out on Earth Day in 2015. And it was Bill McKibben, Paul Hawken, like the original, sustainable investment gurus, going all the way back to the 70s, really. They were, preaching this stuff. But then it was also a group of astronauts and other, thought leaders, physicists and biologists, and I became friendly with Ron Garan, who was an astronaut that spent 6 months on the Russian space station. And I'm sorry, on the International Space Station, not the Russian space station. And, as a fighter pilot in Afghanistan. And, we started talking about his view of Earth and what was changing, even over 6 months of going around the Earth, every 45 minutes, that they were starting to see material changes in the landscape, through the images from NASA. I started thinking about, what if I really care about these issues, what is the thing that I can mostly do? Can I recycle? Can I be a more thoughtful educator to my clients? Can I be a better steward or fiduciary? And then I saw Jeremy Grantham from GMO put out this data point that said that, I don't know if you've ever read Drawdown.
I have not.
Drawdown is 100 ideas that basically could be addressed to stop climate change, renewable energy, and all of these things. It's probably one of the seminal books in the industry. And Jeremy Grantham came out with this study that said movement of capital would actually reduce CO2 more than the top 16 recommendations of drawdown combined. And that like hit me like a lightning bolt. And I got to meet Jeremy and spend some time with him. And I mean, you talk to that guy for about 15 minutes and you want to rush to the bar and just start drinking heavily. but anyway, it really made me understand that movement of capital was the only thing that was going to do anything to solve the problems that we have today. And then I got to work at the UN a lot and started, you know, talking to all the people over there and Will Kennedy and Elliot Harris, the, you know, head economist there. And I started understanding that in order to solve the sustainable development goals, not that we even really have a shot of solving them, you know, by 2030, but even to come close, there was an enormous amount of capital that was needed. You know, estimates are $2.5 to $5 trillion a year. And it wasn't going to come from NGOs or the private markets.
Yeah.
It was going to come from, you know, publicly funded companies, pension plans, investors. And that connection had to be made. And I wanted to be in the middle of that. I wanted to try to make that happen in my corner of the world.
Yeah, it's interesting. So your story, and thanks for sharing, reminds me, my brother, Jonathan, we started Common Good together. Today is in Rwanda. He had a previous stint in Sierra Leone. And in between that, he went to Yale and got his master's degree. And his thesis, and I'm guessing this would have been 10 years ago, maybe longer, maybe even longer now. But anyways, it was about this whole idea of getting capital flowing to areas that need it. And he saw it firsthand in Sierra Leone. And you just realize that, yeah, capital can be extremely positive and it can also be negative, but you got to get capital flowing in that way. So look, I think the other side of that coin is this idea of stewardship. And you mentioned it. What does stewardship mean to you as you think about this question?
I think the problem with modern day economics is that we took land out of the equation back in Adam Smith's day. You know, so it used to be that in the economic models that land was part of the economic model. But at that point, there was like unlimited land and human capital, unfortunately, became the driving force of economics. And we took land out of the equation, and that allowed us to not look at land as an equation or part of the equation of that model. The fact that we were, you know, tearing through land and the resources that land provide, because when you think about land, then it's everything that encompasses. It's, you know, the mining products, it's wood, it's lumber, you know, it's just everything in that. It's water. But we eliminated all of that, and nobody stopped to say, you know, wait a minute. We're living off this living, breathing, you know, system. And if we're going to be good stewards, that actually is the most important asset. You know, when I talk to guys like Matt DeSario at Water Asset Management, water is not a replaceable resource. It's the only irreplaceable resource. You know, we could find an alternative to gold and copper and silver and nickel and wood and steel and everything, but we can't find a replacement for water. So I realized that, you know, there's a good book out of England called Donut Economics about, you know, bringing land back into the equation. But I realized that we've got to be stewards of the planet. And if we bring that back into the equation, then we'll understand how to use money for good and effectively, as long as we add that into the equation. And then, you know, with that comes being a good social, you know, steward as well, because there's obviously lots of human rights issues that, you know, we financially have supported throughout history for almighty dollar that can't just, you know, we can't not address at this point. And there's an ultimate cost to doing that, that a lot of people ignored for short-term profits that we just can't do anymore.
Well, I'm going to go on a limb and say I am hopeful that 2020, and by the way, I don't think it just stops when you get to 2021. I think that it continues. But my hope is that there is a renewed understanding of how we're all connected. So China and America are connected, and that relationships matter and how we spend our capital matter. I mean, I actually get the sense that people more than ever are saying, I want to be a part of the solution. Now, I think it's a long ways to getting to where we need to be, But to me, I think, and I would never wish what happened to happen last year to happen again. But I also think it's kind of shifted people to saying, wait a second, we need to think a little more holistically about the environment, about the way we treat other people, about social, about racial. So I'm going to go into 2021, which we're in right now, with this optimism that we're going in the right direction, although at times it doesn't quite feel like that.
I always say we live kind of in a spiral, like a spiral vortex, and we kind of move up and down. You know, it's not just a straight trajectory up.
Yep.
If you're looking down the spiral, things look pretty horrible. But if you're looking up the spiral, things look pretty promising.
So, yeah.
You know, your perspective is really critical. And I just wanted to add, there's a line in Planetary by a female Buddhist teacher that says, to me, it's the most profound line of the movie. It says, we're not on this planet, we're of this planet. That hit me. It's still, every time I say it, it goes right through me. We have this opinion that we just, you know, landed here and we're on top of this planet and we can do whatever we want to it. And yet the truth is, this planet birthed us. I mean, this planet was here long before we were. Somehow the forces of this planet and the chemical makeup of this planet and everything allowed for us to evolve out of this planet. So we're of this planet. And it's like, you know, when people say it's our mother, you know, and people have weird interpretations of that, but we were birthed from this planet. I mean, that's a fact. That's not a weird spiritual context or dogma. That's a fact. But we're not treating it that way. And we have to change that. We have to, because the planet will be fine. I mean, when people say we're killing the planet, that's absurd. We're killing our ability to live on the planet. The planet will be fine for it'll rejuvenate long after we're gone. But if we want to stay here in relationship to this planet, we've got to really be thinking about that relationship and be good stewards of that, you know, planet. So our grandkids have water to drink and air to breathe.
Let me end with the biggest question of them all. If you could make a dream come true for your life, what would that be?
I've had moments in my life. I've been meditating since I'm 13 years old. I have moments in my life where I'm not spending time dwelling about the past or worrying about the future, you know, and that you can call that flow, you know, is a simple way of describing it. And my goal has always been to live in that place more and more, because when you're in that place, then you're really present with another human being and you're not operating out of fear and guilt and resentment and all the negative aspects of ego. And if we could all communicate from a really present, focused place without all that baggage, then we can start to come up with the solutions that will really heal, you know, our divide in this, you know, country and our divide with the planet. You know, the reality is you can only work on yourself. You can't change anybody else.
Yep.
But if I could represent, you know, myself at the best I can be, then maybe I have a shot of inspiring, you know, one or two other people doing the same.
You know, your comment about we can only control ourselves and change ourselves is so true. And I've just been reminded over the last year specifically. So I think this idea of controlling yourself, and then to the extent that we all can reach out and influence and touch somebody else, this world will be a whole lot better. A whole lot better place. The problem is, if you just sit there and focus on yourself, then you're missing everything. But you gotta be healthy enough so you can go grab somebody else and love on them and make this world a better place.
If I could just end, the definition of success in our book, which you have on yourself, is you're aligned with your unique creative expression and use that in service to the world. That's when you're truly successful.
No, it's right. Well, yeah, and that's it, which flows into the name of what we created when Common Good. It's this idea of what you just mentioned. And I think to me, the financial system, like, it's great here in the United States, but the next level is to take it simply off the focus of the investor and start to look at how that investor interacts and interplays with others. I think that's where the real joy and freedom comes in. In addition to not only the great things that your capital can go do, but ironically, there's a joy and a freedom that comes when you invest your capital that way.
Yeah.
Experience that you've experienced it. And keep up the great work. I know you're a pioneer in the space and love to see your name out there. And I appreciate you taking the time to join us today. So thanks again for joining.
Thanks, brother. Really appreciate it.
Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. We'll see you next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.